future athletics. Isn't that a problem?
Senator Ted Farrioli convening in the temporary absence of the chair. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Rules. Today we have two items on the agenda, Senate Bill 901 and Senate Bill SJR 44. We'll begin with Senate Bill 901, and that is a bill that specifies that the amateur Olympic athlete is not an employee for the purpose of certain employment-related provisions. Colleagues, I think we moved this bill out at one point in time. Now we have to bring it back and and talk about comporting amendment, which would be the dash two amendment, and we'll let the committee administrator explain why we're in this dilemma and what is the remedy.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair and members of committee. Senate Bill 901 expands the current exemptions with regard to employment coverage, wage rate payment, collection and claim enforcement, employment conditions, employment of minors, and unemployment insurance for individuals who have been declared an amateur athlete under the United States or Canadian Olympic Committee, to additionally include amateur athletes declared as such by a national body governing amateur sport or its state affiliate. Further, the bill recasts and reclarifies the definition of employee to include and apply the exemptions for declared amateur athletes. The Dash 2 amendments recast the current proposed language with regard to unemployment insurance provisions to include amateur athletes who perform services as such for governmental entities, 501c3 nonprofit organizations, or Native American tribes in order to conform with federal law. Fiscal and revenue impact statements both indicate a minimal impact associated with this legislation.
Thank you. Our first witnesses are Tim Bernasek, Ron Robinson, and Doug Piper.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Bernasek, an attorney at Dunn Carney in Portland, representing the Western Hockey League and the Portland Winterhawks. Very much appreciate the opportunity to be here to testify on the bill. And Senator Ferrier, I just wanted to clarify one issue. This is the first hearing of this bill. But we do, again, appreciate being here and appreciate your willingness to consider this today. I'm going to be very, very brief because the stars of the show are sitting to my right. What the bill has been described does is simply clarifies the current understanding of the status of the players on the Portland Winterhawks. They are amateur athletes. This is the sort of highest level of amateur hockey in Oregon, and this has been the understanding in Oregon and all of the states. In fact, the workers' comp section clarifies or discusses this, the amateur status that we're now asking to be replicated in the wage and hour and unemployment statutes, just to clarify the situation. The reason we're here before you is a result of a lawsuit that was filed up in Canada, where there is some they're alleging that these amateur athletes are in fact employees subject to wage and hour laws. And so again, as in the United States, the Canadian provinces have had the same understanding of these players, and many of their provinces, as well as the state of Washington, have clarified and put in statute just to make this abundantly clear what the status of these athletes are, and that's what we're asking to do today here in Senate Bill 901. So with that, again, I'm very pleased to have Ron Robison, the commissioner of the Western Hockey League, here, and unless you have questions for me now, if there are questions, maybe at the end of the panel, I'll turn it over to Mr. Robison, and then Doug Piper will speak as well.
Perfect. Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you, Chair Burke, and members of the committee. My name is Ron Robison, Commissioner of the Western Hockey League. Thank you for the opportunity to address your committee today on behalf of the Western Hockey League and our Oregon-based franchise, the Portland Winterhawks. The Western Hockey League has been recognized for nearly 40 years on a worldwide basis as the premier development league for amateur hockey players. The Western Hockey League is a member of the Canadian Hockey League, which is comprised of 60 teams based throughout communities across Canada and northern United States in the Ontario, Quebec, and Western Hockey Leagues. The Canadian Hockey League is the number one supplier of talent to the National Hockey League. The CHL is also the leading supplier for Canada's national hockey teams and Canadian university hockey programs. All Western Hockey League U.S.-based teams and their players are registered members with both Hockey Canada and USA Hockey, the governing bodies for amateur hockey in these countries, and are recognized as the highest level of amateur hockey in the system. All of our teams, including the Portland Winterhawks, play integral roles in the communities in which their franchises are located, from supporting local charities and a wide variety of minor hockey and local sports programs. Our teams are also a major source of community pride and have a major impact on the local economy. The Portland Winterhawks were the first Canadian Hockey League franchise to be based in the United States after relocating from Edmonton in 1976. In 1983, the Winterhawks became the first U.S. team to host the Memorial Cup National Championship. For over 40 years, the Winterhawks have been regarded as a premier franchise in the Western Hockey League and have developed many players who have not only gone on to the National Hockey League, but have also had highly successful business careers, thanks in large part to the advantage that they've taken of the Western Hockey League Guaranteed Scholarship Program. Our WHL clubs invest heavily in providing a world-class experience for all of our players. The players' well-being is the Western Hockey League's top priority. The WHL world-class experience includes high-caliber coaching, world-class facilities, extensive health and safety initiatives, anti-doping and mentorship programs, and coverage of all the necessary expenses to play in the league. The WHL also provides our players with the most comprehensive education and post-secondary scholarship program available in North America today. While playing in the WHL, players receive the support that they need to achieve their academic goals as well as pursue their hockey objectives. Each year, over 350 of our graduate players from the WHL access their scholarship to attend post-secondary institutions throughout Canada and the United States. Since 1993, over 5,500 players have benefited from the scholarship program. Thank you again for the opportunity to address your committee, and I'm certainly pleased to respond to any questions you may have.
Thank you. We'll wait until the panel's complete. Thank you.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, thank you very much for having me. My name is Doug Piper. I'm the president of the Portland Winterhawks Hockey Club. I'd like to begin by explaining a little bit more about how we fit into the hierarchy of sports. When you look at our athletes, some people think, oh, you've got some high school kids out there playing your game. And actually, we have the sort of elite athletes that you see at the University of Oregon or the Oregon State University in the football or basketball programs trying to get to the NBA or the NHL or the NFL. And so to get to this elite level, like those athletes do, takes a lot of work and a lot of expense on the parents' part. And so to get to this level, you're seeing athletes that are on the brink of getting into the National Hockey League, and that's what our job is to prepare those athletes. Right now, we have about 25 alumni that are active members of the National Hockey League, and so our whole system, the league-wide system, is to prepare those athletes for that opportunity. The Portland Winterhawks employ full-time 40 employees. We have a couple of hundred more employees that work for us part-time. We work out of the Memorial Coliseum and the Moda Center. We pay a 6% tax into the city system for the Spectator Facility Fund, which is used for things like rebuilding Providence Park for the Portland Timbers and other benefits of that nature. Benefits to the players are immense. Imagine if you're a parent and you're bringing your kid up through the ranks of hockey. You're paying tens of thousands of dollars for equipment and ice time and other activities. When they reach our level, all that expense goes away, and it's something that the parents and players really try to achieve, because if they get to our level, they really have a shot of being professional athletes at the highest level. And so that benefit, along with the benefit of the education program that we put together for the players, understand that our players, for each year that they play for our teams throughout the league, receive 1 year of college education or trade school education for that experience. So they don't have to choose to go to a college hockey experience. They can come to us and get the same experience. They can play for us for 4 years and get a four-year college education. And I think it's fair to say that we're just as proud of the doctors and lawyers and electricians and plumbers that we've produced out of our system as we are with the National Hockey League players and their experience. So That's really all the testimony I have, but if you have questions for us.
Thank you, and thank you for your work on this. This has been a good process, and Mr. Bernasik has been a great educator on this issue. So, questions from the panel? Thank you very much. David Gerstenfeld.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm David Gerstenfeld, the Unemployment Insurance Division Director at the Employment Department. The Employment Department does not have a position on this bill, and I'm here just to talk about the Dash 2 amendment, which I think is the dilemma that Vice Chair Ferrioli was referring to, and it really has to do with some potentially unintended consequences. The unemployment insurance program is operated by each state, but we have to stay consistent with federal requirements. If we don't, the consequences are potentially losing the administrative grant that we get from the U.S. Department of Labor to administer the program. That's about $53 million a year. Significantly, it also means that Oregon employers would lose a tax credit that they receive against their federal unemployment tax, the FUTA obligation. If that were to happen, that would mean about an extra $500 million a year in payroll taxes for Oregon businesses. We did hear from the Department of Labor that the bill as originally drafted would create a problem with us being inconsistent with those federal requirements. We've provided a copy of that information to Legislative Council, who concurred, and the Dash 2 amendment really just addresses that. And it takes language that already exists in the unemployment insurance statutes to address this very type of dilemma in other circumstances and uses that same language here. And that's really why we have the Dash 2 amendments here. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. It was quite shocking to me to think that a worthy bill like this could bring down the entire Oregon business community. But thanks to the Dash 2 amendment, it looks like the crisis has been averted. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Okay, that completes our list of witnesses. Anybody else want to testify? If not, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 901 and open a work session on Senate Bill 901. And we have before us a Dash 2 amendment. And Cherie, we have our paperwork all in order, correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay, Senator Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 901.
Senator Ferrioli has moved the Dash 2 amendment for Senate Bill 901. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, I move I move Senate Bill 901 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ferrioli has moved Senate Bill 901 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Roblin, as the committee member with the most experience with student athletes and education, would you like to carry the bill?
I would be honored.
Okay, thank you. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 901 and open up a work session for the introduction of committee measures. And we have one in front of us. Cherie.
Madam Chair, we have legislative concept 4378 in front of us that's been distributed and posted on OLIS as required. It's my understanding that this is a bill that is an agreement between the chair and vice chair for introduction through committee.
Thank you. This is a bill committee that I would anticipate being referred to the Joint Committee on Marijuana Legalization. We're doing this as a courtesy for that committee. Senator Ferrioli and I are. But of course, this does not imply opposition or support for the bill itself. So with that, Senator Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, I move that LC 4378 be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Ferrioli has moved that LC 4378, dated April 4th, 2017, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Thank you, committee. And now we will open up a public hearing on the bill that I have been waiting all session for, Senate Joint Resolution 44. Cherie.
Madam Chair and members, Senate Joint Resolution 44 eliminates constitutional provisions prohibiting an individual who has given, accepted, carried, or agreed to cross state lines for the purpose of accepting a challenge to fight to a duel from holding public office. The resolution refers the measure to the ballot at the next general election. Revenue statements indicate no impact, and fiscal paperwork indicates an indeterminate impact at this time. There are no amendments.
And we have the honorable sponsor of this fabulous constitutional amendment, Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Brian Boquist. I am from House District 23 in 2005, presently serving in Senate District 12. In 2005, when I had the distinct honor to be elected to the House, one of the first things I did was read the Oregon Constitution. I hate to say this. I don't think I did it in high school, Senator Roblin. And so I started reading the Constitution, and I actually kind of checked some marks off, because the first thing that caught my eye and has always caught my eye going down through it is there is a clause in the Oregon Constitution, as good counsel here said, that refers to dueling. And you would have thought, wow, why do we have a dueling statute in our Constitution? Now, actually, what she didn't cover a few things with you is dueling has a long history in the United States in political arenas. We've actually had one president who participated, I think, in four duels when he was the president, including expediting one individual rather rapidly. And then we also had the famous duel between Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. So, being such a civilized legislature, historically speaking, and doing something that Senator Courtney does, is during the 1845 legislature, second one we actually had here, Mr. Gray and Mr. Applegate, two names you should remember, Applegate Valley, Applegate, Jesse Applegate, decided that it would not be very civil if two members of the legislature disagreed and shot each other on the front steps of the provisional capitol. So they passed this particular portion into the Constitution, which is where it comes from. And to accurately state what it does say, which is ironic, is that dueling used to be legal. In fact, there really is no prohibition today for it being illegal, and I will remind the members that are sitting before me in this esteemed committee that the Senate, I think, unanimously passed a new clause allowing for unarmed combat to be regulated by the state police. But that's really not the purpose of the bill, Madam Chair. So let me bring you to the purpose of the bill. When I read it in 2005, I flagged that, and I actually went down and I highlighted my Oregon Blue Book. And I have that Blue Book with probably about 20 highlights in it of portions of the Constitution that either, one, are seriously outdated, two, I guess don't allow us to duel, so I'll say, three, are clauses that we ignore, or four, there are things that we should have changed because we do it a different way completely, and we just sort of go out there. Couple examples of that, and that's really the purpose of bringing the bill forward. We, two sessions ago, what the Senate did and the House is we directed legislative counsel through the rules committees to say, go back and look at the statutes and start cleaning up our statutes, because most of us know, especially who've served in judiciary, there's a whole bunch of laws that we just don't use anymore that are seriously out of date. Now, the dueling clause in the Constitution is one of those, and so it raises to the highlight of saying, this is one that we certainly need to clean up and move away. There are several other things in there you probably have forgotten about, that we have quartering of soldiers in the Constitution too, and I don't think that's going to happen any way, shape, or form anytime soon. We actually have nobility and heredity in the Constitution still. And, oh, by the way, there's an old slavery issue about immigration that's actually in the Constitution too, which we ignore too. The problem with ignoring all those things is eventually they catch up to us. Here's a good example. Oh, and I forgot, we have a stationery clause. I want you to know that most of your stationery is probably in violation of the law, because we have a constitutional clause on how we can use our stationery. We also do not have a balanced budget amendment. Contrary to popular belief and legislative counsel, we have traditionally heard these things. When I first came in, about the only legal guidance I received in 2005 was, you must balance the budget. You cannot bind a future legislature, and you have to have, you know, the supermajority for revenue to it. Well, the only thing I've really ever found in the Constitution that supports any of that is you do have to have a supermajority to do a revenue bill. So here's another example. The balanced budget amendment is really a combination of Article 1, which says the legislature can, in Article 1 of the Constitution, legislature can actually form the budgetary agencies that are out there. And then two combinations of Article 9 of the Constitution, Section 2, which says we have to pay for current expenses, and then we have to make up deficiencies down in Section 6. So we have two sections, 2 and 6. And traditionally speaking, these three combinations, which have never once been challenged in court, are the combination of the balanced budget amendment. Just for your edification, there is a new legal opinion floating around this building, which I have read, and it separates out Section 6 of Article 9 of the Constitution and says that any money that the governor spends, we are required in a fiscal year to raise taxes at the end of that fiscal year to cover that debt. Now, exactly how we got that and we're seeking clarification, I don't know. But my point being that I'm raising here is besides ships prior to 1935 in the Constitution, having an appropriation Section 4 of Article 9 is that you cannot spend any money that's in the Treasury. This is sort of the one where we've all said that, you know, if we're out of balance, we either have to come in and raise taxation or the governor has to cut in an equal percentage going down. It has always been taken out and set aside and worked with separately. Now, with a series of actual legal opinions under process, the separation of each of these little sections as a standalone are about to create a major problem for us. And I must say, I wouldn't even have known about Article 9 of the Constitution because I was so bored by the time 2005 I got to finance, and I wasn't on finance, I skipped it. But one of the good senators here managed to get me put on the Joint Transportation Committee, and Article 9, Section 3 has become a daydream of mine on taxation. So really, Madam Chair, members, the purpose of this bill is to bring to highlight the fact that the legislature needs to take a serious undertaking with legislative counsel and go back and refine those sections of the Constitution either piecemeal, like dueling, or in whole and go through and identify those arcane pieces that we have and fix them before we find ourselves facing the reality that the state of Washington has, which is being fined $100,000 a day by their Supreme Court. So with that, Madam Chair, I don't have $100,000. I do have the capability to do a duel, but that is the purpose of the bill.
Thank you, Senator Boquist. Senator Beyer.
A couple of points, Madam Chair. Sure. One is, I know the Washington State has fined them, but to my knowledge, they have no enforcement mechanism to make the Washington legislature pay. What you're talking about is we need a constitutional revision.
That's exactly right.
And I believe the state of Oregon created a constitutional revision committee in 68, 69, which put one on the, spent a lot of time, a couple of years, put it on the ballot where it was soundly defeated.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, you're right. There's two points that you've run. One is if you had $100,000 a day, you could probably pass it. And two, it was soundly defeated previously. But nonetheless, we're now facing, as we go into the 21st century, and people are trying to, you know, split peas in half and come up with other mechanisms, we've sort of outsmarted ourselves in the legal realm. And my prime example is the fact that we do not have a balanced budget amendment. And when you split that apart, you've opened legally Pandora's box. And so there are multiple sections, a lot of discussion in the building going on around a whole variety of topics, which we're not going to raise. But the point of this bill is as Senator Beyer pointed out, Madam Chair, is that we really need to do a revision, or we need to start marching down the road and take it piecemeal. The most palatable, I would have assumed, would be a revision. And we would go in and revise and change those portions of the Constitution, and that would probably take an act of one of the two Rules Committee to instruct Legislative Council to do that, which is sort of what I'm proposing right here, though I would love to be able to challenge people to a duel on the floor of the House. I like everybody in the Senate, so I wouldn't do that. but that being said, we do face a serious challenge. and it's probably going to come to the forefront faster than we have. I mean, there are areas like Article 9, Section 3, in which we're splitting hairs. We've been on it in the Transportation Committee and some of the things that have to be done there. But until you go to the Supreme Court and have one portion or the other struck down, they're interesting enough. There are other sections, even in Article 9, that most people are not aware of, and that is there are contradictory sections in terms of the retirement and retirement funding in there that contradict Section 4 of the Constitution. And I'm, as we know, there are bills before the committee, Madam Chair, in which legislative counsel has said we probably shouldn't do that because it's probably not constitutional. But being a good military officer, just because it's stupid doesn't mean we're going to do it. And so we have passed things into the Constitution and sent to the voters that actually contradicted other sections of the Constitution. And with that, I would be delighted not to take questions.
Senator Roblin.
I'll just make a statement or two, because the $100,000 a day they don't mind paying, because the edict that they in Washington did, the bill that was supposed to pass on funding it, is a lot more than $100,000 a day. And so it's a cheaper way out to pay the fine than it is to pass the bill that the that the court told them they had to pass. So it's been interesting to watch that. It has to do with about education funding. And the other one, that our president that was in those duels, he always let the other guy shoot first.
That's right. That's correct. I have no problem with that. I'm not a member of the House I'm worried about.
Well, I'm deeply disappointed that the ambitions for this bill are bigger than dueling, because I was all set to go after dueling, because I think we ought to have freedom.
To duel?
To duel. Yes.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Unfortunately, we're not in.
Hey, you don't even have to move. It's already there. It's already there.
That's right, Madam Chair. My ask is that, you know, since the House is the upper, the House is the lower people's chamber, and the Senate is the upper chamber with a little bit more experience, that we probably need to start addressing this issue. Because I'm in regards to my other assignment as the co-vice chair on transportation, I mean, I deal on a daily basis with entities threatening to take us to the Supreme Court over a variety of competing issues in the Constitution. And now when we compound that with other sections that are out there that are fairly out of date and maybe arcane, it still provides the opportunity for individuals to come up with rulings we certainly would not want to be voting upon later.
Well, in the meantime, I'm going to get the transcript of your testimony and send it to the Oregon Bar Association and try to get you an honorary law degree. Are there other questions or comments? Thank you very much, Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I will close the public hearing on SJR 44, and that completes our business committee, so we are adjourned.
A wonderful day.
Completes our business committee, so we are adjourned.
A wonderful day.